doctors bamboozled by jargon, blinded by science, and turning to Google in the hope it'll become your new best friend. Well, this is the concept behind Naked Health. It's to strip medicine right back down to its basics, to cut out the jargon, tell it as it is, and really make it accessible to everybody. My name is Penny Ward, and I currently work as a GP. I feel that in my role, I'm touched by so many lives, so many stories and experiences. I want to take you on these journeys with me, seen through my eyes as a doctor, but told using the voices of everyday people. Hello and welcome back. Today, before we start, I want you to imagine Swiss cheese. Slices of Swiss cheese scattered with holes. You're going to go to 100 cheese counters and ask for one slice of Swiss cheese from each of them. You're going to take your 100 slices home and pop them one on top of the other. What are the chances of all the holes matching up? There is a chance, right? A chance so tiny, so small you might dismiss the idea, not even look because it's so outwith the realms of possibility. The chance of the holes matching is, say, less than 1 in 100,000. The same chance as a 27-year-old developing bowel cancer. So the question today isn't what happens if the holes line up, it's being ready for when they do. Today, I'm really lucky to have a special guest from Scotland. Obviously, being able to do this remotely has been able to bring geography closer together. So Olivia, hello and welcome to Naked Health. Thank you for chatting to me.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Not at all. The reason I wanted to speak to you is because, am I right in thinking you're 31?
31 at the moment, yeah.
And you have had quite a turbulent time, to say the least, haven't you, leading into that big 3-0. I wondered if you could take us back and give us a little insight into when things really changed from the trajectory that you imagined your life to be taking leading up to your 30th birthday.
Yeah, absolutely. So I got married to my husband in 2014. And I'd say maybe a year later, I was doing my PGD in primary training, teacher training. And I started getting some strange symptoms, kind of, I was always bloated and I'd always have the runs or constipated. It would kind of go between both. And as time went on, my symptoms got worse and I started getting stomach cramps. So I did start going to the doctor and I probably went to the doctors for over 2 years. And towards the end of the 2 years, it was maybe once, twice a month. Okay. Just with those symptoms of constipation, diarrhea, I also had blood in my stools, extreme stomach cramps to the point where I would be vomiting. And then I lost about 2 stone over the whole time as well. And I didn't have 2 stone to lose. So I was down to about 40, 43 kilos. So I had lost a lot of weight. However, it was just because of my age, because I was 29 when I was finally diagnosed. So 27 to 29, people just kept saying, you know, it's just a food intolerance or it's IBS. That was the one that kept coming up as well. Someone once thought I had an ectopic pregnancy because we were actually trying for a baby at the time as well. Okay. So all of these things. So I had cut out dairy and wheat. I still keep finding food diaries. We've done so much cleaning up recently and I don't know how many food diaries. And it makes me really sad looking at the diaries thinking, gosh, I was so desperate to find out what this was. So yeah, it was misdiagnosed for 2 years, which was really tough.
And how many times had you actually been to see somebody, do you think, in that 2 year period?
Oh gosh. I mean, maybe like 20. I think the problem, quite often towards the end as well, it would be emergency appointments. You know, you phone up and you say, I need to see someone today. And it would be the on-call doctor. So it was quite often a different doctor I'd see. If I'd seen the same person, you'd then build up a relationship and they would see that I was losing this weight. And they would also, I would have thought, seen from notes that I had not been to the doctors before this. Every time I was at the doctor, it was for the same reason. So, you know, I'm not a hypochondriac, I'm not at the doctors a lot. So I feel a bit frustrated that it did take that long. Yeah, it was every single symptom of bowel cancer. I'm literally, every time I see, you know, it's just my age that put them off.
And any blood tests or any investigations at that point?
I had blood tests at one point. I think they just did it once. And it came back that I was anemic, which again is another symptom of bowel cancer. But they put it down to, I think it was period at the time. And you don't want it to be anything too bad. So you want to believe them. And you trust them, you trust your doctors.
Of course. And you, like you say, you genuinely want to believe that at the age of 27 that this might be IBS and cutting out gluten or something might actually take the pain away and get things back on track again for you.
Yeah. And exactly. So yeah, I did. I went to the dietitian as well, who did all these tests and stuff. Yeah, just a waste of time. My great grand died of bowel cancer a long time ago, and I remember saying in one of my appointments that I was worried that it was bowel cancer, and I got a kind of smart response and just said, "No, you're far too healthy, too young, too fit. Don't worry, it's not bowel cancer." And again, you think, oh, thank goodness, because you don't want it to be that. And hearing it from, you know, a professional, you think, okay, well, then it's not that.
And I think what you're saying is reiterated far too many times, isn't it? That people are looking at face value at somebody's age and somebody is still going to work and they appear okay. Yeah. They're making the decision that actually cancer is for predominantly over 50s and kind of forgetting it doesn't discriminate in that way.
No, exactly. And after being diagnosed, I've met so many people through online, on Instagram especially, and it's unbelievable the amount of people that I've met exactly the same age as me with the exact same story. Count myself very lucky, considering how ill I was, that they did catch it before it had spread anywhere else other than my bowel.
I think that's a hugely pragmatic approach, given the frustrations that I can only imagine you went through and the treatment that has followed, you know, to think that you're lucky.
I think it's because I do see so many people online. Probably if I hadn't seen all of the other people that are in a worse situation than I am, maybe I'd feel a bit like, oh, poor me. But because I have seen people that I've also lost over the last few years to it, that I have genuinely made friendships through, and it's kind of like a double-edged sword. You know, it's great, and it's great that you've got all that support, but then when you do lose someone, it hits you and you realize the reality of what it is and how close you can be to not being here, which is terrifying.
As a doctor, this is pretty galling, to say the least. I think more so because it's not the first time that I've heard about huge delays in diagnosis. And I know that unless something changes, it's not going to be the last. We just have to keep talking about it, raising awareness and saying over and over again, young people get cancer too. In fact, 2,500 people in the UK alone were diagnosed with bowel cancer under the age of 50 every year. Do you know, when I think back to the reasons I wanted to start this podcast, it was to try to break down barriers, to help people be advocates for their own health, to be aware of changes in their body, what they may potentially be when they need to seek help from health professionals, but equally when they need to try and help themselves. So if you see blood in your poo and are completely well with it, you have 3 weeks before this is considered a persistent change, which is going to warrant further investigation. So my advice would be, use this time wisely. Keep a food diary. Write down what you eat, when you eat, and if you think there's a link to the blood in your poo between gluten or dairy, exclude it completely from your diet and keep going with the diary. Keep a poo diary. How many times do you go? What does it look like? Is there blood? What colour is the blood? How much blood is there? Is the blood mixed in with your poo, just seen on the outside of your poo, or just present when you wipe? Is it sore when you open your bowels? Ladies, is the blood in your poo related to your period? If you're constipated, then increase the fibre, increase the fruit, increase the fluid intake, and try over-the-counter laxatives if needed. Can you feel piles, tender lumps around the outside of your bottom? If you can, Get some Anusol. You can pick it up yourself and give it a try. Then at 3 weeks, if it persists, go to your doctor. Tell them about your poo. Tell them about the blood. Show them the food diary. And if appropriate, say you've excluded gluten, you've excluded dairy, you've treated potential piles. Tell them you're worried it might be cancer, that you would like to get yourself checked. Because someone's that one in 100,000, and you don't want to find out in 2 years' time that that someone was you. There's another aspect of being diagnosed with cancer when you're younger, before you've started or completed your family. Fertility. Is the cancer itself or the treatment that you're going to have to undertake going to affect your fertility, your chances of conceiving? Are you still going to be able to have your own biological children? Olivia's going to chat to me and share her experiences about this.
And in terms of your treatment, you've had everything, haven't you? And I think certainly looking at your social media pages, I can tell you've been to the hospital a lot. You're doing dances with the nurses. You know your surgeon by first name. You know, you have been to the hospital for your surgery, several surgeries, your chemotherapy, your radiotherapy. You've had the works, haven't you?
Yeah, I do feel like they literally threw everything at me. I don't know if there was any other treatment that I could have had. When I was first diagnosed through colonoscopy, I was told that I'd have to wait a few weeks, you know, to find out the plan. However, the week after I was diagnosed, I became really ill, even more ill. My mum flew over from Dubai and her and my husband Sam kept taking me back to my surgery and said, there's something wrong. She's getting worse and worse. And my mum eventually just drove me straight to the hospital. And it turned out I had sepsis from the colonoscopy, then kind of rushed through scans and things. And that's where they found that it was stage 3. So, you know, it was pretty far on. And because of the sepsis, they decided to give me a stoma. So I woke up on Christmas Eve with a stoma, which I always remember being absolutely terrified about. When I found out I was diagnosed, I thought anything but a poo bag, as I like to call it. But it was the best thing that happened to me. I wasn't in pain anymore, which was the nicest thing. Yeah.
Especially after being in pain for probably that full 2 year period, to have that turned off.
Yeah, it was incredible. I didn't care that I was pooing out my stomach. Yeah, I just felt like I had my life back again. Even though I knew I still had cancer, I knew I had lots to get through, but it was, the fact that I wasn't in pain was incredible. And I was told that originally my tumor was about 8 centimeters up and about 8 centimeters wide as well. It was too big to operate on straight away. So that's why I was told that I needed chemotherapy and tablets and then radiotherapy to shrink it first. And then that was the point they also told me that after radiotherapy to my pelvis that I wouldn't be able to carry children, which was worse for me. That was worse than hearing it was cancer, because hearing it was cancer was kind of a weird sort of relief, because I finally knew what was wrong. You know, I knew there was something wrong, but I didn't know what it was. So yeah, hearing that I couldn't carry children was just kind of chucked in there. I thought, how on earth has bowel cancer now affected my fertility? But yeah, it's put me into menopause. Then I started the radiotherapy and the chemo tablets, and day 4 I didn't feel right. You kind of really get to know your body. So spoke to the nurses and it turned out I got sepsis again. So plans were changed and they decided to try and operate on me without shrinking it. And my incredible surgeon, Doran, I just love her. She got the whole thing out, and she also, my stoma was supposed to be permanent, but she managed to put my bowels back together, which would mean in the future I could have it reversed. So yeah, it was a crazy few months.
A crazy few months. As you're doing a sort of whistle stop tour through your story there, actually, there are positives to take from your journey, I think, as well, if I'm hearing you right. The fact that you had the stoma that helped with the pain.
Yeah.
Had the operation that probably didn't on paper look like it was going to be successful, but it all came out in one, and then a chance to reverse the stoma. But I do want to touch on the fertility side, because I think it's such an important part of who we are as women if we want to go on and have children. And talk me through that conversation that happened when when they actually told you that it was going to affect your fertility? Who sat you down and had that chat?
So I had had, it was my oncologist, who's lovely, Dr. Sanders, and he was talking about what the treatment was going to be and that it was stage three and then I would need radiotherapy. And he thought I'd actually already been told that this would stop my chances of ever carrying. So he kind of just dropped it in and said, and obviously this will mean you can't carry. And that was hearing it for the first time, not his fault at all. You know, he thought I already knew. Yeah. But my mum and dad were there and Sam and I, and it was just awful. I think I swore a lot, which shocked everyone. Actually, no, they probably weren't shocked, but yeah, it was horrendous. It was really, really awful. But Nine Wells, which is where I was treated with everything, they were incredible. And they had my appointment booked for just an hour later. So we just kind of got on straight away we went to the fertility clinic and I started the injections that night. So it was really quick, really, really quick.
So what options had they given you at that point? Did they talk you through what your options were?
With fertility, with my eggs, it was just I either can have my, because it was we wanted children. That was I definitely wanted to do something. So it was just we could either freeze my eggs on their own, but there was a really low percentage of that working in the future, or we froze embryos. So we were married and that was what we wanted to do. So we did all of them. We wanted to make them embryos.
Did you have to go through essentially part of IVF in terms of injecting drugs to try and harvest the number of eggs?
Yeah, that was it. So I went for a scan that day as well and they checked my ovaries and they were all fine. And then, yeah, it was injections, which Sam did and my mum did on me every day for, I'm not quite sure, maybe a week. And then I went in to have my eggs harvested and Sam got to do his, so much easier for men. He did his little, you know, donation. And yeah, then we had to wait the 5 days after that to see if they'd worked. So yeah, I think it's very similar to what people go through with IVF. And it's now we've got the embryos. They just, instead of putting them in me, they've gone into my incredible cousin.
Just sort of thinking at the embryo stage, was there a time frame given to you when they said that they'd frozen them? Did they say these can remain frozen for X amount of years?
I've heard of people being told that they can't be frozen for that long. I don't remember the years, but I felt like the reason I don't remember the years is because they said that they would last for longer than I would ever need them. I never felt pressured to using them.
You didn't feel like a clock was ticking in terms of...
Yeah, no, not at all. No, I didn't at all. Obviously, we were keen to get on with this part as quick as we could. We just needed to find someone. But no, I don't ever feel like it was a pressure that we needed to do it quickly.
Good, because you obviously still had all of your treatment to get through and get back to health, didn't you, whilst they were sitting waiting for the after.
Yeah, exactly. And considering how much treatment I did have, they actually did it quite quickly. I was diagnosed mid-December and then mid-July, everything was done, all clear. And then, well, apart from my stoma being reversed, that was interesting. That wasn't quite straightforward.
I'll come back because I want to ask you about the stoma reversal actually in a little bit. So how long out of finishing treatment and getting some strength back did you feel able to start looking for a suitable surrogate?
Not that long. We both said that we wanted to just have like a normal life because we hadn't, even though it was only diagnosed the 8 months before, our lives weren't normal because I was so sick for a long time before it. So yeah, we went on holiday. We just wanted to be us. And yeah, we didn't think too much about it. But then it just, maybe 2-3 months after, we decided, no, this is, we're happy to go back because we had been trying. It was definitely something we wanted, you know, soon. So yeah, it must have been September time sort of that we decided to look into it. And I joined Surrogacy UK, but the waiting list was really long to get onto that. And we both felt a bit funny about not knowing, you know, having to go down trying to meet someone that's then going to carry your baby. And yeah, we just, it all felt a bit strange. And then my cousin came out of nowhere. I'd only met my cousin once when I was about one. We just lived in different places. There's no other reason why we hadn't met. And she sent me a message, an offer to carry. And I remember bursting into tears because that was it. We knew at that point that we'd at least been given the chance to go down that route and try and make a family. Because without her, we can't. It's strange that everyone else can keep trying. I know it's not easy. I know, you know, lots of people have fertility issues, but when you physically, you cannot, and you need another person, it's quite scary. And so she took that away.
That is just an incredible gift to give to anybody, isn't it?
Yeah.
I suppose for people listening, how easy is it to talk to somebody about potentially being a surrogate? I mean, you didn't really know your cousin, I'm assuming, because you'd lived in different areas. How do you even start that conversation?
Yeah, I know it's an unusual one. But my cousin is so, I didn't know how to, she's just very matter of fact. She's always said, why would I not do it for you? Because I can. She's got a little boy and she doesn't want any more children. And she doesn't think it's an unusual thing to do. She's like, my body can do it. So, and I know how much you want it. So it was from the start, it just seemed right.
Yeah.
It wasn't awkward or anything. It was strange because we were getting to know each other as well as going down this incredible journey together as well.
And I guess I don't really know much about this next stage. So you've got your embryos frozen in Ninewells. Where does your cousin live?
An hour from us, an hour and a half. So back in November, she had to go through a lot of, we had to have counselling together and separately. There was a lot of appointments, which felt like they were taking a long time, but actually it didn't take that long, within about 5 months from start to transfer day. So all of that was done at Ninewells. But then when we found out it worked, our first embryo worked, it's all now done in her local hospital, which is great because then it means we get to do the traveling, because you obviously want to do as much as you can. You don't want her doing any more than she's already doing.
Of course. And what are the chances of the first embryo taking? Because that's pretty slim, I'd imagine.
Yeah, well, it was just amazing. So when they freeze the embryos, they tell you what grading they are. Yeah. And anything, is it a 3 or something, they don't freeze because the possibility of them working is so low. So we had, they said, 2 very good embryos and then 2 good embryos. And the very good ones, you have a 50-50%, you know, chance of them working. So it's quite high. Yeah. And then the good ones, I think it goes down to 30 to 40% chance of working. So they always said that they would do the very good ones separately. They wouldn't put 2 embryos that are very good in because the chances of multiples are very high. And then when it goes down to the good ones, they would put both of them in. But obviously it worked. Yeah. So I think we didn't realize until, again, now that I see a lot of people struggling with IVF. We're so lucky that it worked first time.
Incredibly lucky. But I have to say, you probably deserved a break at this point. How long was it before she could do the pregnancy test? Because you must have all just been counting the hours.
Yeah, we all said this is going to be a nightmare having to wait. They said we had to wait 2 weeks. So when they put the embryo in, the embryo is already 2 weeks and 5 days old. So yeah, so they put them in and they said 2 weeks time. And it was about 6 or 7 days later and Ellie texted me, and my cousin texted me and said, do you mind if I do a pregnancy test? And I thought, like there wasn't a doubt in my mind. Absolutely, 100%, go for it. Yeah. And I also did think, I wonder if, I don't know, never been pregnant. I don't know if you can tell, you know, from 3 weeks if you're pregnant or not. But I felt like she must know something. Otherwise, why would she ask? And so the next morning, because I think you have to do it in the morning, don't you, the test, she just sent a picture through and she just said, congratulations, you're pregnant. Oh, gosh. Yeah.
I don't know if I can probably explain or describe what you guys must have felt at that point.
Well, I always had, I'm such a cheesy person. I always loved the idea when it was a normal pregnancy before everything. I always had so many different ways of telling Sam. I thought, oh, I'll, you know, set up a camera and then I'll put a bun in the oven, or, you know, I'll get him a card. And, you know, I had so many different ways. And then when this happened, that was all taken away. It was all very medical. And obviously now someone else is carrying. I wouldn't be able to do that surprise. So I didn't actually tell Sam that Ellie was going to take the test that next morning. So yeah. When we woke up and I saw the text, our friends were actually dropping their little 15-month-old off for us to babysit for the day. And I don't know how I didn't tell him. And it must have been about 2-3 hours later. And this little one, Sky, had fallen asleep on me. And I was thinking that I'll go out for dinner and I'll, you know, again, all these crazy ideas. And then it just came out and I just said, Sam, is this a good time to tell you something? And he said, what? I said, we're 3 weeks pregnant. And the two of us were just, oh, it was just best moment ever.
Moment I can imagine. Where are we now? How many weeks away from Ellie giving birth to your little girl?
So roughly 66 days. She's actually going to have a C-section. So we're waiting to find out the actual date, but she's due mid-July. And we're just hoping that the next hurdle is to find out if we can both be there for the birth, or at least be in the hospital to get her as soon as she is here. So yeah, that's the next stage. But whatever happens will happen, and we've got her for the rest of our life. So I don't want to worry too much about the logistics of her getting her.
I know, and I think we touched on this a bit earlier, didn't we? The timing with the COVID pandemic couldn't be any more against you in potentially being there. But like you said, it's focusing on the not necessarily being there, which would be wonderful, and I hope you are. But if you're not, you do have her for the rest of your lives.
Yeah, exactly. And COVID is, yeah, it's a nightmare. We've not been able to see Ellie. So we've missed hearing the heartbeat for the first time, and we're missing the kicks and missing, you know, not having our voices around her. But Ellie's got this app that we record, and then she puts little headphones on her bump so that hopefully she'll kind of know who we are. But at the same time, I'm not able to work, so I'm at home, which means I've got so much time to get the nursery sorted, buy all of these things that I probably won't need, but I'm going to buy anyway. So that's a plus of being in lockdown.
It is, and actually I'm pleased that you're in lockdown and getting all of the things done that, you know, you probably wouldn't have had a chance to do otherwise.
Yeah, exactly.
Keeping yourself safe as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Can I come back to a couple of stoma questions, if that's all right? I know a lot of people like yourself will have been absolutely terrified of the mention or the thought of a stoma with bowel cancer. And you've already said actually it was one of the best things that happened in terms of symptom control for you. What about the reversal? Was that obviously something to get excited about and you'd be pleased to have it gone, but did it make you fret or worry that some of the pain or the symptoms might come back?
I thought the stoma would be the worst thing in the world, but as I said, it was the best thing that could happen, and I got used to it so quickly. And I know everyone's different, but that was my experience with it. When I found out I could have it reversed, I wanted it gone. You know, I'd kind of got it in my head that it was permanent, so I came to terms with that. But then knowing that it was going to go, I couldn't wait. I was really excited. And then, yes, I got very nervous thinking about, oh my gosh, I've not pooed out of my bum for 10 months now. What is it going to be like? And yes, totally, 100%, the fear because of the pain I used to be in every time I went to the toilet. It was excruciating. So I was really worried, but my husband is incredible, as is my surgeon, and they just kept reassuring me that it wasn't me going to the toilet that wasn't why it was, you know, it was a tumor that was there, which was blocking me being able to go to the toilet, and that's not there anymore. So it won't be like before. But mentally, that was quite hard to get my head around. And then when I went in for the reversal, it was all fine, all went well. But after a couple of days, I still hadn't been able to go to the toilet. And it turned out I'd got this thing called ileus. So my bowels went to sleep, which is apparently quite common. And they went on strike. And I think I probably, out of everything, that was probably my most challenging part of treatment and recovery. Because I was in hospital now, not because I was ill. Like, this was, you know, nothing. It was strange. I found it really, really hard. Cried a lot. Couldn't sleep because I was in pain because of the ileus. Yeah. And I think it was just over 100 hours, I think I worked out, that I then finally went to the toilet. And I was so happy. I then had to get a drip, a tube down my nose, because I kept being sick, and it was really nasty. It was not nice at all. But then, as soon as I started being able to go, my goodness, I couldn't stop.
Your bowels had started working again.
Yeah, and they didn't stop for days, weeks, months. They're still not back to normal. But no, I'm still really wouldn't have changed having the reversal. But Imodium was my friend, is my friend. I don't really know what I would do without that.
It's a weird psychology, isn't it? Like you say, you went in to have it done when you were well this time, and then an ileus is a kind of an expected complication, I'd imagine, from that. But your abdomen, your stomach is so huge and bloated and uncomfortable, isn't it? And the vomiting. Hard to probably get your head around when actually it's something you've chosen to go in for, although of course it needed done if there was an option to have it done. Having the stoma, how was that to manage in terms of, you know, not just how to stop it leaking and how to change your diet, but in terms of, could you still wear your bikini to go on holiday? And you know, all the practical things for a 29-year-old having that in place.
Yeah, I think before I had it, I thought it was the worst thing. And I thought if I did have one, I probably would hide it. But I was the complete opposite. And I just wanted to show everyone it and raise awareness, because I didn't know anyone with one. And so I wanted to make it normal, because it is a normal thing. It just doesn't matter where you poo from. It was, you know, as long as you're healthy. So I showed it off all the time. And my poor husband, I quite often, if it was, because you saw it working and you could see the poo coming out, and I'd be like, look, Sam, how cool is that? He's like, oh, yeah, lovely. So no, I really showed it off all the time, just wanted to educate people, even with going back to work. I'm a school teacher and I love teaching them about stomas and what your poo should look like and what's healthy. And I did buy some pretty fun bags, which again just motivated me even more to show it off.
I love that you tried to normalize it for school children, because I know there's been a lot of work trying to get cancer onto the curriculum and get people talking about their bodies from a really young age, because I think certainly in our generation, there's still a stigma, isn't there, about talking about different body parts and things that are perceived to be something you should keep quiet.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I really love educating them. I remember the first slide I had with them was, does everybody poo out of their bum? And I think even saying poo and bum is like a funny thing for a teacher to say. So yeah, I absolutely will continue doing that.
I think that's absolutely brilliant. And then hopefully the generation that's growing up will not only be more open in talking about these things, but actually be aware what their body is capable of, what's normal for them, and when to really get themselves checked and push for that if it's not right.
Yeah, exactly. Because if I'd known more, I would have definitely pushed more. I would have been more persistent, although I was pretty persistent going. I would have not, I would have just pushed for more answers rather than just being kind of, yeah, bobbed off really.
It's all easy, isn't it? In hindsight to think what you'd do if you had that time again.
I know. I try not to think about it too much, but sometimes I do feel, you know, frustrated thinking that if they had just, if it's caught early, it's so easily treated and I wouldn't be going down menopause, which is, menopause is awful. And I wouldn't be going through surrogacy and, you know, it would have just been a quick operation, removed and done. But
I mean, as a doctor, I feel pretty frustrated and not very happy about the journey that you're describing. So I'm hoping that not only are people listening to this for themselves and their loved ones, but, you know, it raises awareness all around that really age can't be something that we of either thinking yes or no, this could potentially be cancer because we're going to get it wrong if we go by that.
Yeah, exactly. I do a lot of talks at my surgery and stuff and for bowel cancer UK as well. And it is just not okay to say to a young person that it's definitely not that without checking.
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. Are there any final thoughts or words of wisdom that you would like to share or you'd like people to know or you think people don't know or aren't aware of that they should be?
No, I think you know your body best and don't let anyone tell you otherwise. If you think there's something wrong, then there probably is something wrong. So don't let them think they know everything because nobody knows everything, but you know yourself the best.
The theme running through this episode is possibility, that nothing is black and white. We can't have a yes, no, always, never outlook. And just like my Swiss cheese analogy, there has to be room for potentials, possibilities, chances, and there has to be room for hope. Olivia's little girl is due in mid-July, and for me, she's everything possibility and hope stands for. And you know what? Olivia might be counting down the days till her arrival, but so am I.
Little tomcat, stay close to me, cause there are clouds on the horizon and a chill on the breeze. We're alone here, but don't you be scared. I've got a calloused hand, a farmer's tan, and I'm happy to share. You and I'll both get by, just promise you won't stray. All that I need is some dirt and a seed, and I will feed you till the summer blows.